And today we begin a new series on Talk of the Nation. What makes a great blank? It's a good way to learn about what it takes to succeed in various kinds of demanding jobs. Next week, for example, what makes a great mayor? If you have thoughts about that or suggestions for future programs, send them on to us by email. The address is totn@npr.org, and we begin today with what makes a great athlete. Grace, speed, agility, strength, determination, those seem to be qualities of every good athlete. But what makes a great one? Michael Jordan's competitiveness, Roger Clemens' obsessive conditioning, Serena Williams' power and sense of fun. This hour, we'll talk with coaches, athletes, psychologists, and observers about the magic formula of great athleticism, and we want to hear from you. Who do you think best personifies these qualities? What assets do you admire in particular pro or amateur athletes? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And our first guest this afternoon is Mark Shapiro. He's Executive Vice President and General Manager of the Cleveland Indians, and he joins us from his office at Jacobs Field in Cleveland. And Mark, it's a pleasure to have you on.
It's good to be on, Neil. Thanks.
We wanted to start with you because you evaluate talent at a number of different levels. I know, for one thing, you can't be too far from getting ready for baseball's annual draft, where you're looking at kids who are just out of high school, some of them, or in the case of kids from the Caribbean, even younger than that. What do you look for?
Well, I'll tell you, that's a broad question, and it gets back to kind of your introduction there, and that with every single player, and it's kind of the beauty of our business, and it is the artistic side of the business, you know, you're looking at a number of variables. You know, there are some that are quantifiable with statistics. There are many other that are not quantifiable, and those are mostly in the mental domain. We call it makeup in scouting vernacular, but it has to do with toughness, character, leadership abilities, communication. Basically, to me, the ability to filter out all the extraneous conditions that can keep a player and prevent a player from achieving his potential. So we attempt to quantify all these things, medical, and put a value on a player. And it is an inexact science. It's a difficult science. It's challenging. And it's also what makes building a team and selecting players the part of the job I like the most.
In a sense, you're trying to find out about a player's heart.
You do try to measure those things. And again, what you said is very true. When we acquire talent, the business of player acquisition, you're acquiring it on a variety of levels, the amateur level through the draft, high school, junior college, and college, the free agent major league level, which is you've got a much greater database, or the trade level, which is somewhere in between. In all those cases, what you try to do is take the domains that exist within that player, do the best possible job of rating or evaluating and accumulating information as you possibly can. And I think where there are unknowns, that affects the value you place on the player.
What are the differences between a player you might be considering for a draft, a young kid, and the differences in what you're looking at in him and somebody you might be thinking about promoting from your AAA team and bringing onto the Major League Club from Buffalo to Cleveland?
Well, with the AAA players, we've normally had anywhere from 3 to 5 years to not only evaluate them and get to know them, and for them to get to know us, but also develop and teach them. That's the beauty of baseball and the separator and the differential from all other major league sports, is that when we draft our players, they go into a player development system that's curriculum-based, that truly is an educational system. And not only are we teaching them baseball skills, but we're trying to develop the player in a holistic philosophy, at least the Cleveland Indians are, developing them mentally, physically, and fundamentally. And so we're teaching them life skills, we're teaching them mental skills, and we're ingraining in them Cleveland Indian values. When you're evaluating an amateur player, you might get a chance to see that player play 5 or 6 times over a year period. That's if you're lucky. Individual games, and you might have different people see them, and you might have a chance to talk to them once, have them fill out a questionnaire, but the wealth of that information is still going to be far below any player you're bringing up from your own farm system.
One of the oddities of the baseball farm system is that winning is not necessarily the most important thing for those farm clubs. You're trying to develop players for the major league level.
That's right.
But isn't winning itself, don't you have to teach kids how to win? Isn't that a quality too?
Well, I was a farm director for 5 years. As a former farm director, I can tell you one of the most important characteristics and traits that I wanted our players to learn was to expect to win, not hope to win. And for the Cleveland Indians in the early 1990s, as today, the greatest challenge was to develop that winning psyche with a major league team that did not have that affiliated. I mean, when I got to the Indians, the only thing affiliated with the Indians was the movie Major League and more of a comedy than it was a championship team. It became a lot easier when we were a championship team throughout a good 7-8 year stretch. But, yeah, I think you want to win without a doubt. Neil, the balance is you don't make decisions, ultimate decisions, when they come between development and winning, you lean towards development. But you certainly can make decisions that satisfy both goals to win and develop.
I should point out that the experts at places like Baseball America currently evaluate your minor league system as the most prolific in all of baseball. So congratulations on that. Can you take a call with us?
Sure.
Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's talk with Shannon, who's with us from Modesto, California.
Hi, Neil. I just wanted to say thanks for taking my call.
Appreciate it.
I just wanted to comment. I'm a big baseball fan. We used to have season tickets to the San Francisco Giants when I was a kid, so I've had that love instilled in me by my father. But I always remember the best players being the ones that showed heart out on the field, and I think the truest example of that is Dave Dravecki, the former pitcher who had to have his arm amputated. I mean, even as a very young child, I can remember just, you know, the charisma he brought on the field. But that there seemed to be a real love in his heart for the game, which just made it really enjoyable, and there's such an absence of that today.
I wonder, Mark Shapiro, you know, obviously that level of dedication, it's hard to test for that, but is that something you look for?
It is. I mean, to me, it's a separator. And not only is it a separator, from a personal philosophical standpoint, I was having dinner with Sean Casey, one of our former players, last night. It's also a friend of mine, and, you know, we talked about, you know, basically, there are so many unknowns with human beings, physically, medically, that the one thing you want to know as a general manager when you go to bed, the one thing that will allow you to sleep at night is whether that player cares, and that is a measure of his heart. And, you know, I can wonder a lot of things, but what I don't want to wonder is whether or not a guy wants to win and whether he takes pride in his performance. And I think what Shannon was describing is, you know, ultimately we want players that have pride not only in their own name, but, you know, pride in the name on the front of their uniforms, the city they play for. They understand that responsibility. It's a greater challenge today, not because of the game of baseball. It's a greater challenge today because of our society. And it's more, I think, a reflection of the challenges we have as a culture in trying to develop leaders and trying to develop those traits in a much more quick-paced and instant gratification-based society.
Shannon, thanks very much. And I think anybody who ever saw that horrible moment when Dave Dravecki's arm broke when he was pitching will always admire the quality of heart that he exhibited
okay.
That day. Appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks very much.
Mark Shapiro, what is it, do you think, is there something you can categorize when you see that great athletes who have a lot of promise and who have developed a lot, is there one reason that you can think of that they fail?
No, the derailers are many. There's not one reason. But a lot of times the guys that are blessed with so much natural ability and talent haven't developed a framework that allows them when they're encountered with all the distractions. You know, you take a person who life was very easy for as a high school athlete. Not only was the sport easy, but the dating life was easy. The accolades came easy. Everything he did in his life was easy in his small town or even in a big town as a high school competitor. The pressure mounts, the stakes are higher, more people depend on that person, more people pull at that person, and those pressures, that person has not been programmed or trained how to deal with those pressures. So there are some elite athletes like a Michael Jordan who are also elite mental performers, and those are the people that are they're at the very top of the pyramid, and they're rare talents. There are many others who need to be trained and develop a system and an approach for how to deal with pressures of balancing, pressures at home in a marriage or relationship with the pressures they take to the ballpark, pressures in dealing with fans, financial issues, umpires, weather, and all those things can very easily derail a player's performance on a nightly basis and then snowball to derail his career.
Makes your job pretty interesting, doesn't it?
It does. It's one of the great things that we're not dealing with hard assets like real estate or stocks or certificates. We're dealing with human beings, and it does make it interesting and sometimes frustrating. But ultimately, to me, that I view this as a creative business, and that's what makes it creative.
Mark Shapiro, thanks very much for being with us today.
It's good to be with you.
Mark Shapiro, General Manager and Executive Vice President of the Cleveland Indians, and he was with us from his office in Jacobs Field in Cleveland. The role of steroids in enhancing athletes' performance is one that makes fans, officials, and athletes all a bit edgy. Joining us now is Professor of Health and Human Development at Penn State University, Charles Yasalis. And, Professor, it's good of you to be with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Obviously, all of the attention recently is about steroids, but those are not the first performance-enhancing drugs exactly, are they?
No, the athletes today and the athletes of yesteryear had a rather imposing menu from which to choose, from amphetamines to blood doping products to things that build your muscle, such as anabolic steroids and human growth hormone and insulin and insulin-like growth factor. Very long list.
When were steroids introduced?
Steroids were first developed introduced into medicine in the late 1930s. They were officially or formally brought into sport very likely in the early 1950s, probably by the Soviet athletes.
And what's their particular appeal? You mentioned they build muscles?
Well, they build muscle and increase strength. And there's very few sports that you and I could name where a good big man or big woman could not be a good little man or woman. So strength is really a very important aspect in many sports. In addition, it is very, very likely that these drugs allow even endurance athletes, such as marathon runners and distance swimmers, to train more frequently with greater intensity for longer periods of time. In plain words, it allows you to recuperate from your workouts.
Are they banned because they're bad for you, or are they banned because they're performance-enhancing?
Well, I think they're both, that people are concerned about the deleterious health effects of these drugs, as well as the unfair competitive edge that the drugs will convey.
Any way of measuring how much they may have distorted our athletics on any number of levels over the past, you mentioned since the 50s?
It is very difficult. My personal opinion, meaning I couldn't prove it in a court of law, but I strongly believe that the large majority of world and Olympic records that have been set over the last 34 to 40 years have been drug-assisted.
The large majority?
Yeah, that's my opinion.
And that would go across swimming, track and field, all those kinds of things?
Yes.
Is there any way that you think that this epidemic, if that's what it is you're describing, can be brought under control by testing?
I think it's highly unlikely in that if this latest episode with the, this is at least the fifth example of which I'm aware of, designer drugs. Drug testers can only test for those drugs which they know. There's literally daily new drugs coming in to play in our medical care system. There are disreputable scientists who are watching for those drugs that might be applied to sport. There's the whole specter on the horizon of genetic engineering and how it may be applied to athletics. If you look at the past to predict the future, the cheaters have continually bested the testers, and frankly, I don't see how that's going to change. This latest scandal with THG, it was not brought about by drug testing. It was brought about by a disgruntled coach FedExing a partially filled syringe to the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. They took it from there and gave it to the drug testers. But had that package never been sent, it is highly unlikely, at least in the...
Charles Yasalis, I'm afraid we're going to have to cut you off there, but thank you very much for being with us today. Charles Yasalis' most recent book is Performance Enhancing Substances. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We are talking about the qualities of great athletes, and you're invited to join our conversation. The phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN at npr.org. And let's take a call from Ting, and Ting's on the line with us from Calgary in Canada.
Hi, Neil.
Hi, welcome.
My name's Ping D'Souza. I'm an Australian Olympic speed skater.
Yes.
And I've always found a lot of hope from the stories I've heard. And I've not met very many, you know, truly amazing athletes, but I've heard many of their stories. And one of them is a gentleman named Abdul Basir Wasaki. And have you heard of his name?
I have not.
Okay, well, in the 1996 Atlanta Marathon, he was the Atlanta Olympics, he was the only athlete representing Afghanistan, which at the time was ruled by the Taliban government.
Mm-hmm.
And at the Atlanta Olympics, the marathon is traditionally held on the last day, and during the games, he broke his foot. And he still started the marathon, which is a pretty amazing thing. And after 3 hours of running, pretty much everyone had finished, and he was only at the halfway point. And a reporter came up to him, and they asked, "You have no hope of winning. You're going to finish dead last. Why are you still running?" And this gentleman, Abdul Basir Wasaki, said, "My country did not send me here to start. They sent me here to finish." And after, I think it was 4.5 hours, but I may be wrong, may have even been 5 or 6 hours, he finished the Atlanta Marathon dead last in the slowest time ever recorded in Olympic history. And I've always been trying to track down Abdul Basir Wasaki, but I've never actually met him. So
that's an inspirational story. I wonder, as a speed skater, I did have the chance to watch Eric Heiden perform in the Lake Placid Games when he won 5 Olympic gold medals. And if you look at somebody like him, I mean, what's the difference between you and him?
Between myself and Eric Heiden, I think there is very little difference. Because when you talk about elite athletes, the difference between the greatest, whoever was, Eric Heiden, and I think of him as a hero, and I've met him on several occasions, and myself, a speed skater from Australia, which I believe we are the bottom-ranked country in the ISU ladder at the moment, the difference between Eric and myself is very little. And that small difference could be genetic. Some people call Eric Heiden a genetic monster, but it's also a mentality. And I'm sitting here in Calgary, about 10,000 miles away from my home in Melbourne, and I'm trying to pick up that mentality, and I'm trying to learn from all the greatest skaters in the world. There's a World Cup in a few weeks, and I'm just trying to meet everyone and trying to learn from them, because in Australia, we don't have a proud tradition of being great speed skaters. There's Danny Carr, who was a world champion, and Jimmy Lynch, another world champion, but that's it. We don't have people like Eric Heiden or Joachim Uttahager, you know, the great skaters of the world. So I'm just trying to pick up the mentality of it sitting here in Calgary, where it's very cold.
It's cold in Washington, too, but I suspect not as cold as it is in Calgary.
Yes.
Thank you very much for being with us, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Appreciate the phone call.
Bye-bye.
Joining us now is Mark Murphy. He's a former Washington Redskin, and he was on that team with 2 Super Bowls. He's currently director of athletics at Northwestern University. He's with us from the campus in Evanston, Illinois. And Mark Murphy, good to talk to you.
Oh, great. It's good to be here, Neil. You should also mention I'm a former NPR commentator.
All of our guests are former Morning Edition commentators.
Yeah,
Mark.
That's right.
Ralph Wiley also is with us by phone from Hollywood, California. He's a columnist for ESPN.com page 2, one of the few, I understand, who's not been a commentator for Morning Edition. Ralph, welcome.
I know, but we're all in line for our turn. Nice to be with you.
Thank you very much. Ralph, what do you think are the key elements to being a great athlete?
Well, truly great athlete, if you see it, that's the thing. You know, when you say truly great, a lot of guys can play. A lot of guys are physically gifted. What makes an athlete great? And it doesn't have anything to do with steroids, and it's not anything a steroid can affect, except in a negative way, you know, severe mood swings and stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to do with a vision, a poise, an awareness, a depth of character, an ability to adapt and overcome and maintain an equilibrium and poise under duress. Not everybody has it. Not everybody has what, say, Bill Russell, Jim Brown, John Elway, Barry Bonds, Sandy Koufax, Muhammad Ali, people like this have. That's what makes them great, if we can use that term, describing an athlete.
Mark, let me ask you the same question, in a way the same question that I asked Ping. I mean, you were obviously a very good player to get to where you were, and a very fine player in the NFL. Not, though, you know, in that category of, you know, the super great. What was the difference between you and another great, you know, secondary player, a Ronnie Lott, for example?
Well, I think that's physical. He was just a lot more talented than I was. You know, I think once you get to the professional level, I mean, you have to have a certain level of physical ability. But what makes the truly outstanding, and I think Ralph's right, I mean, I look at things like competitiveness. I mean, you almost have to be driven to excel at that high level. And it varies a little bit from sport to sport. But the truly great athletes have what I call an athletic intelligence, that or a vision where they see things unfold before others do. And that's something that it's – you really – I think it's almost innate. You know, just – you see just some players, whether it's basketball or football, that just see things that others don't. And it just gives them such an advantage. And I think work ethic. I mean, you know, the truly great players are hard workers. And I played with some players with the Redskins, you know, whether it was John Riggins or I think of a player named Kenny Houston, who's in the Hall of Fame.
Sure.
Was the hardest worker I played with. And he was a very gifted athlete, but he pushed himself and was very competitive. And I think that's really what made him a great athlete.
Ralph Wiley, again, we hear about that work ethic thing to the point where it's become not meaning in any way to put down Mark Murphy, but it's really a cliche. I mean, we pointed out at the beginning of the program the obsessive conditioning of a Roger Clemens.
Yeah, and it's not really cliche when it's applied individually. You know, in a collective it might be a cliche, but then when you look at a Jerry Rice, for example, who might not have been much faster than Mark Murphy if they were running, you know, a 40-yard dash in shorts, but for a guy with a stopwatch. But you see, that's track. You don't play track. You play football. And Jerry Rice's work ethic was unparalleled for any number of years, which is why he slowly amassed the greatest record really any football player ever heard of. It had more to do with his drive, as Mark said, his inner drive, his competitiveness. And it may hurt him now because, you know, you can't just turn it off, and he doesn't know how to quit. So now he can't quit the game, even though he probably should. He's 41 years old. But he doesn't know how. He can't. That's how he got to be Jerry Rice. So it's an interesting phenomenon.
You know, it's Neil, it's interesting. You know, football, of all the sports, is the one where, you know, especially scouts and coaches, I mean, they try to quantify it more than any other sport. You know, what's your height, your weight, your speed, you know, how much can you bench press. But they make more mistakes than they don't. I mean, you look at, I think a great example was, you know, in the draft a few years ago, you know, the top two quarterbacks were Peyton Manning and Ryan Leaf. And, you know, it was back and forth about who would be the top pick and who was going to end up being the better player. I mean, in hindsight, you look back on it and you say, how could people have thought that there was any comparison between those two? But when you looked at his height, his weight, his arm strength, I mean, Ryan Leaf was off the charts. But
exactly.
You know, he lacked.
It's got to be more than just the physical gifts involved. Yeah. Although, as you say, you know, you got to start with that. Mm-hmm. But then there's separation between the guys who have the physical gifts, as you just point out.
Well, the problem is, I mean, you can't measure heart. It's hard. You can't measure, you know, drive, competitiveness, and, you know, but I think the truly great players have that.
Let's get some more callers involved, and Brianna joins us on the line from Northville, Michigan.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I listen to your show constantly.
Well, thank you.
I just wanted to say that my sister, Kate, trains with the U.S. Women's Olympic rowing team, and really what makes her stand out in my mind is that she's had to sacrifice so much to be where she is. That, you know, her family, we all live here in Michigan, and she lives in New Jersey, and currently she's going to California for intensive training. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult for her to maintain any kind of you know, long-term relationship or see us. And she's really had to put any kind of other career on hold and work just part-time jobs. And I really think that, and I've heard you've discussed dedication and heart, and I think that goes along with it, really. There is a certain amount of sacrifice of any other kind of life that comes at that kind of level.
Excuse me, Mark Murphy, I think the phone's for you.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. I'll have somebody answer and get it off.
Thank you very much. Brianna, we didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no problem.
Are you done?
I
just wanted to ask about your sister. Is she trying to go to school at the same time as she's doing this incredible training as well?
No, and the interesting thing is that she started rowing at the University of Michigan and was given an extra year free by the school because she was such a standout athlete, was given the Athlete of the Year award there. But she has her degree in biochemistry, and she's not pursuing that at all because there's really no way for her to pursue what she's interested in career-wise and row at the same time. It really takes over your whole life. Like I said, she doesn't have much of an opportunity for a social life or further education.
I wanted to bring Mark Murphy in on this because at Northwestern University, you're involved obviously not just with the Big Ten football program, but a lot of less watched sports. And I don't know if they have rowing at Northwestern, but and a lot of dedicated athletes on the amateur level. And you could speak to Brianna's sister, I think.
Oh, absolutely. In some ways, you look at the truly outstanding student athletes. You know, being an elite athlete, you know, especially at a 1A football program or Division I college, you know, that's a major time commitment. And then you add into that the academic rigors. There's really not a lot of time left if you want to excel both athletically and academically. I think the really elite athletes do have to make sacrifices, and whether that's a social life or other opportunities that they may be able to have on campus. That's something that's really been discussed by an awful lot of people within higher education. You know, I think the recent book, Reclaiming the Game, really looks at that. You know, we've created a system where, you know, the athletes are specializing, and is that to a negative effect to them? I mean, the other thing I look at, it's been a fascinating change over the last 15 to 20 years. You know, I think one of the things that really allowed me to be an NFL football player was the fact that I played basketball all through high school and, you know, for a year in college. You know, the athletic ability that I learned from basketball carried over. Now, you know, kids are being forced at a very young age to specialize. You know, if you want to be a college basketball player, you have to play basketball year-round, you know, from 7th, 8th grade on. And, yeah, I think it helps to a degree, but you end up getting an awful lot of people burning out, and you don't get the benefits of playing other sports and different coaches, different kinds of athletic attributes that you would get otherwise.
And I'm told Northwestern does have a rowing team. Brianna, thanks very much for the call.
Well, you know, Neil, Brianna's sister didn't say, and that's the difficulty when you're talking to somebody one step removed from what's at hand, but she didn't say whether – sounded like her sister to me was going to be an Olympic rower. That's what it sounded like to me.
That's what it sounded like to me as well.
So, I mean, yeah, that's going to take a vast amount of commitment, and she was uncomfortable with it. It was apparent to me. Her sister was uncomfortable with it. But the real question is Brianna uncomfortable with it? I don't think you can do it if you're uncomfortable with it. And, yeah, you do have to put some things away from you, but, you know, I think it's very good discipline. I think Mark's point about having to specialize is really a great point. And, yeah, you might end up with a little better basketball player who isn't much good in the company softball game later on in life. You know what I mean? He's not as well-rounded because he doesn't do all those things.
As a bad softball player, I can tell you there are worse things to happen in life. We're speaking with Ralph Wiley and Mark Murphy. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we've been talking a lot about the mental aspects of athletes. And joining us now is Garth Weiss, who's a performance coach for pro athletes, mostly tennis players and golfers. He's with us on the phone from his office in Orlando, Florida. And it's good of you to be with us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking a lot about team sports. How does mental toughness differ between an individual and a team sport?
In the individual sports, you're focusing more on a very specific environment. Whereas the team sports, you've got the interaction between the players, and there's a lot of leadership issues, maybe some issues with discipline, things like that. With the individual sports, it's a very focused situation. It's a one-on-one tennis match. It's a golfer that's just playing the course. So it's actually a situation where you can focus in more on exactly what they need to work on.
How do you help an athlete work on his or her mental edge?
Well, just like there's physical muscles, there's mental muscles. And I think in a lot of sports, there's this notion that you just want to go on automatic pilot when you play. But as Mark Shapiro talked about earlier, you get into this zone and everything seems to happen very clearly. You just seem to see things before others do. You can actually work on that. If you block out all those distractions, that takes practice. And then once you get to that level, then you can start to use your mind to create what you want your body to execute. Because that's what we found when the mind and body work best, is the mind creates the picture, the body then executes flawlessly.
Do you you're obviously working with athletes at a very high level. I mean, do you point out exemplars to them, a Tiger Woods or a Pete Sampras?
Exactly, yep. Pete Sampras used to train here, so we can use him as an example.
And what made him so good?
He had great rituals. He set the stage year in and year out to stay number one. He had great physical rituals, sleep, exercise, nutrition. He had great emotional rituals, handling setbacks and pressure. He had great mental rituals, handling distractions that we talked about earlier. And then also spiritual rituals that he wanted to be the greatest player of all time. It wasn't about the money for him. And he just did that over and over again so that when a big tournament came up, he didn't have to reinvent the wheel. He just had all those rituals in place.
Can your brain get in the way of your body sometimes?
Oh, absolutely. The biggest problem I see with recreational athletes is they overanalyze. And they might read an instruction manual about golf or tennis or whatever it is, and their brain gets in their body's way and starts to tell them how to execute. And so they've got all these swing thoughts and stroke mechanics cues that they just can't be on automatic pilot when they play and let their body go.
Yeah, I remember a hitter I used to see all the time in minor league baseball, and you could see him as he started to swing, listening to each of his seven different batting coaches and different approaches, and of course he never made it out of the minor leagues.
Yeah, that leads to a slump.
That's led to a career-long and career-ending slump
exactly.
For him.
The voice of doubt comes in then.
Okay. Garth Weiss, can you stay with us through the break?
Sure.
Garth Weiss is on the phone with us from his office in Orlando. We're also speaking with Ralph Wiley, a columnist for Page 2 on ESPN.com, and Mark Murphy, who's director of athletics at Northwestern University. He's with us from their campuses. And we want to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our question is, what makes a great athlete? I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about what makes a great athlete this hour. Tell us what you think. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Earlier, we spoke about how athletes use performance-enhancing drugs. You can hear more on that tomorrow on NPR's Morning Edition. Tom Goldman has the first of two stories about the emerging drug scandal in sports and the previously undetectable steroid called THG. That starts tomorrow morning on Morning Edition from NPR News. Still with us is Ralph Wiley, an ESPN.com Page 2 columnist, and Mark Murphy, a former Washington Redskin, currently the athletic director for Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. And I should point out again, a former commentator for Morning Edition. Also still with us is Garth Weiss, who is on the phone with us from his office in Orlando, Florida, where he's a performance coach for pro athletes. And we wanted to hold on to you for a moment, Garth, because we had a caller whose question we thought you could help us answer. And this is Omar, and Omar is on the line with us from St. Louis in Missouri.
Okay. Yes. I want to talk about these. I think it's very important when you talk about athletes and the success of athletes, the mental state of athletes, and analyzing their overall lives and putting their performance as athletes in the context of their lives. Now, I've been involved in the boxing industry for quite some time, and the most talented boxers I've seen going through the amateurs and initially through their professional careers, almost to a man, have not been the most successful.
When you speak about talented, you mean physically gifted?
I mean physically gifted and at you know early stages in a career were successful, but they weren't able to develop a meaningful life outside of the ring or outside of the sport, and that eventually led to the deterioration of the performance in the ring. You know, particularly, and we saw in this country the demise of the American fighter and the Latin fighter more or less take over the lower weights, and the European fighters begin to take over the heavier weights, because it's just an astronomical number of the fighters we see in this country who get involved in the legal system or get involved in multiple job attorney suits and things of this nature. And they can have all the talent in the world, but if they're involved in this kind of behavior, you know, whether it be criminal or whether it just be antisocial behavior,
right?
They're not going to be able to succeed as an athlete in any sport.
Garth Weiss, that sounds a lot like what you were trying to talk about before.
Yeah, actually, part of it sounds like life skills training, you know, to stay out of problems with the law and things like a lot of the teams are doing now, including the Indians. But the other part is that there's a distinction between physical talent and mental talent. And most of the time we don't really distinguish that. We think physical talent, and then we, you know, get kind of into that intangible world of the mental stuff. Basically, there's 13 mental talents, and I think a big drawback is when we don't identify what they are and we try to make people into something they're not. For example, a real fighter type of person has a lot of heart, can be successful, but there's also a very analytical type of person that can also be successful. Someone who's great at confidence and trusting themselves can be successful, and someone who's really great at has a passion or a discipline or focusing. So there's other mental talents as well that we need to look for, and coaches, if they find those, like I'd say a Phil Jackson and coaches like this, find those mental strengths and then support them as opposed to trying to make one size fits all with their players.
Thanks very much to Omar for his call. And go ahead, Mark. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, during my career with the Redskins, I had several examples where, you know, teammates or people that were drafted that were just physical specimens and were great in practice, but when they got in the game, they couldn't handle the pressure and would just really fall apart. I mean, we used to say they look like Tarzan but play like Jane. That was the I think it's really, you know, how do you handle pressure? When you face adversity, how do you deal with that? I mean, some people just fall apart in those situations, and maybe at a lower level, they never really faced adversity.
Well, to be fair to Omar's point about boxing, I think that's a sport that does not have the same kind of structural support systems for its athletes as, for example, football does, and through high school and college, and then on to the professional ranks. But in any case,
no, absolutely.
Garth Weiss, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
And Garth Weiss joined us on the phone from his office in Orlando. And gentlemen, before we let you go, I wanted to ask you about a quality of athletics and athletes that we hail to the skies, but is it an element at all in being a great athlete? And that's sportsmanship. Ralph Wiley?
Well, I think there's a depth of character that has something to do with it. So, I mean, out of that, yeah, of somebody that would, you know, hit somebody when they were down and, you know, they might not be the person that's really going to make the play you need made in the end. I would tend to trust a Barry Sanders, but as we've seen, say recently with Lawrence Taylor, for example,
mm-hmm.
who had a lot of off the field issues. You know, there might be an element of a lack of a trust, which could be deadly in a team setting. Now, in an individual sport, and I did love the question that Omar posed, and I think like the best questions, that one has no easy answer. I think in individual sports like boxing, you know, the mental edge is even more acute than what Mark described, and I've seen plenty of those play like Tarzan, look like Tarzan, play like Jane types, which is not to offend the Janes out there, but you kind of get the point. In an individual sport, that is absolutely fatal.
Yeah.
You might be able to hide it somewhat in practice or whatever in a team sport and get away with it. But in an individual sport, especially the dangerous individual sports like boxing or auto racing, it's absolutely deadly not to have the mental acuity. And it's the mental acuity. I know it seems odd because athletics are such a physical endeavor, but it is the mental acuity that makes the difference, and it has everything to do with being what would be called a great athlete.
Mark Murphy, a sportsmanship, and again, on the professional and the college level.
Well, you know, I wish I value sportsmanship sportsmanship so much. But, I mean, I guess what I'd say, I think the truly great athletes have the mental ability to turn it off and on when they have to. And I think the really great athletes, they're so competitive and they're so driven, but once the game's over or once the play's over, they can go back and, you know, become a great sport, you know, talk to your opponent and really put it behind them. But in terms of actually making you a better athlete, you know, I really don't see how sportsmanship has an effect one way or the other.
Mark Murphy, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it, and it's a fascinating topic.
Mark Murphy is former Washington Redskins player and currently athletic director for Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. He joined us from there. And Ralph Wiley, we thank you for your time, too.
It's my pleasure, Neil.
Ralph Wiley is a columnist for ESPN.com's Page 2. Often coaches draw out greatness in their players, and joining us now is the head of women's soccer at Slippery Rock University in Slippery Rock, Pennsylvania, and this is Noreen Herlihy. And Noreen Herlihy, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much.
You've had the unique experience of coaching both male and female athletes. Did you have to use different tactics to try to draw out their skills?
Not necessarily so. You know, I'm asked that question often. I really think within the team concept, you're still focused on developing the individual players within what you're looking for as, you know, with the team performance. I think the one big difference for me in my experiences was that just really it's not even the physical aspect. A lot of people, I think, assume that, you know, the men's game is so much more physical. Not necessarily so. It's more the pace of how the game is played with the men's teams as opposed to the women's teams. I think men and women have the same skills. A lot of them have the same technical and tactical ability. But really the big difference that I found from going from one practice session to another is definitely the speed of how things are done.
You can see that to some degree as we watch men and women's collegiate basketball, for example. It's not that the women aren't skilled, and in fact, many would argue the women play a more interesting game in many ways than the men, but they don't have the spectacular physical skills that some of the men do.
Yes, I agree with you. You know, and again, as you said, it's definitely, I mean, I think the women tend to be very focused on, you know, wanting to improve, wanting to learn. I think, as I call them, the lads, you know, tend to just go out there and want to play. And but I think overall, I think a lot of the women that I've had have been as technically good. Obviously, the physical aspect of the game is slightly different. But I think, again, I really think the big difference for me was the pace of how the game is played, as we've just discussed.
We're speaking with Noreen Herlihy, a soccer coach at Slippery Rock University in Slippery Rock, Pennsylvania. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I wanted to ask you, as you coach various players, men and women, do you see people develop and do they surprise you with how they can really maximize their skills and others who don't? Is there some magic formula that you can discuss with us as to why some seem to become so much better than their physical skills might give them the ability to be and others don't?
I think the big criteria here is definitely the mentality of the player. I think, you know, you could have certainly have two athletes with the same physical ability, but I think what separates one to take it to the next level is the mentality, you know, how they handle things, what they're willing to do, how they go after it. You know, and I think obviously, you know, in my experience, I've had players that come in and have great potential, but for some reason, you know, don't, you know, reach that potential. And, you know, as a coach, obviously every year you want to do things bigger and better to improve your team for the next season. But there's no lying that some players make the grade and others don't, even though they could start off with the similar physical attributes. So I really think it boils down to the mentality of the player, how they respond, how much they're willing to put in, and how they can handle adversity and, you know, what they're willing to get out of it.
Let's take another phone call, and this is Audric, who joins us from Forest Grove in Oregon.
Hi. I just wanted to know, what is a better player, either a person who is very good, who has very good athletic abilities, compared to someone who doesn't have as good athletic abilities, but is very positive about the game?
Okay, that's a very good question, Audrey. I think it depends on the with respect to the team game. You need different players of different ability, and you can't have all players that have the same physical and mental attributes, in the sense that within a team order, you need different types of players to blend in so that the overall picture is a positive one. So while it's very good to have good athletic ability, I have on my team right now, I have players that have exceptionally good ability athletically, and then I have some players that are looking to continuously improve, but they're very positive, they're very hardworking. So, Audrey, to answer your question, I think every team needs both of those types of players to make sure that the whole picture is a good one, because it takes all types of varieties of players to make a team tick.
Audrey, what sport do you play?
I play soccer and baseball.
Well, good luck, Audrey, and hang in there, okay?
Okay.
Okay, thanks very much for the phone call.
Bye.
Noreen Herlihy, thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Noreen Herlihy, head coach for women's soccer at Slippery Rock University in Slippery Rock, Pennsylvania. And let's see if we can get one more call in before we go. And Adam joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina.
How are you? Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, actually listening to this, I have so many points now that I could bring up, but the one thing that I really wanted to comment on was the difference between a great athlete and a great competitor. And I played ice hockey for my university, and I played around people that a lot of walk-ons. I was a walk-on myself. I didn't get a scholarship or anything like that, yet I balanced the academic life, the social life, and the athletic life, and I played around people that did that, and I saw things in them that surprised me every day, every practice, that we were losing. We had one losing season in particular. We were out there every day giving our all. And I don't say that I'm certainly not a great athlete, but I think that I see a lot of competitiveness and great character and great competitors in the college ranks today. And unfortunately, you know, we had the athletic director from Northwestern on, but it doesn't get seen a lot.
Hmm.
And it's something that doesn't always translate into the professional level.
Maybe that's the distinction between a great athlete and greatness in athletics.
That's probably it. That's a fantastic point.
Adam, thanks very much for the call. You still play hockey?
No. After university, I hung up the skates.
Probably a wise thing to do. Adam, thanks very much for the phone
call. Thank you.
And that concludes the first in our series, What Makes a Great Athlete, was the first one. Next week, tune in for What Makes a Great Mayor. And if you have ideas on that or suggestions for future programs in this series, send us an email, totn@npr.org. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.